Incorporated against the Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. We have Mr. Kinski for the appellant, Ms. Stoney for the Attorney General. Okay. Mr. Kinski, would you care to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I request 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal.
All right, that'll be granted. You may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, there's two violations that before the court I referred to. One of them as the after-hours consumption in violation of the reg that says the licensee shall not sell or permit to be consumed basically after 2 a.m. The second violation I referred to as the unauthorized manner of sale, which is the regulation prohibiting selling of two or more drinks for the price of one, such as two for one or three for one. Aside from the issue four of attorney's fees, which admittedly we don't get to unless there's a reversal here, there's three issues before the court. First is the circuit court's construction of Code Section 2.24027, the standard review, which was amended in 2013. The circuit court in its ruling blanketly...
When was the circuit court review of this case?
The date of the circuit court mm-hmm. review?
Yes.
It was May, I believe May of 2014.
So it was after the 2000, the effective date of the 2013 amendments, correct?
Yes, well after that.
Okay. And those amendments are procedural, are they not? Since they direct the manner in which the standard of review is to be applied to agency decisions by the courts. So they would be purely procedural in nature, aren't they?
Yes, they would be.
And procedural statutes are effective as to any procedures in effect after the effective date of the statute. So if the effective date of the statute, of the amended statute, was July 1st, 2013, and the hearing was after that, the amended statute would be the applicable statute, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. The 2013 amendments were in effect as of July 1st, 2013. Fast forward about 9 months later, we're in the circuit court in May of 2014. The circuit court said that the 2013 amendments did not change the standard of review, and then conclusively said everything else falls into place, therefore I'm going to deny the appeal and affirm the agency's decision. That was error because the 2013 amendments did change the standard of review in a number of ways. The issues, it changed the standard of review somewhat on issues of fact, giving a little less deference, but significantly it added new language to 2.24027 that said the duty of the court with respect to issues of law shall be to review the agency decision de novo.
Are you familiar with our decision in Blue Ridge Environmental Defense League?
Not off the top of my head.
Well, let me just suggest to you what we said in that case was that the statutory amendments didn't change anything, essentially. The statutory amendments simply codified the manner in which this court and the Supreme Court were already interpreting that language in the APA.
And that was a post-2013 amendment case?
Yes.
Your Honor, this in large part comes down to statutory construction, where the legislature's actions cannot be presumed or cannot be rendered to meaningless, and each
but
word has to be.
Why is a codifying amendment meaningless? In other words, there's case law. General Assembly likes the way. Sometimes they don't like and they move in a different direction, but if they like what the court has said, they then enshrine that into the statute so that the courts can't change direction if they decide to. That's not meaningless.
Right. The fact before 2013, there was what the AG refers to as a spectrum of deference for issues of law. Pure statutory, we all agree, it's de novo review, where it involves an agency's interpretation of its own regulation. The case law talks about giving a deference to the agency's interpretation of their regulation. When the General Assembly acted in 2013, they changed that standard because they don't codify this so-called spectrum of deference on issues of law.
By the way, did you look at the bill as originally filed and then compare that as it worked its way through the process?
Well,
because
that's an enlightening experience.
Yeah, what came out of that, you know, wasn't the mountain, it was the mouse.
Sure, it's often like making sausage, I suppose. But the end result is that the General Assembly added the language, the duty of the court with issues of law shall be to review de novo. They did not say, let's break down issues.
Well, that's always been the case. In other words, the prior statute, the prior form of the statute says, and I quote, when the decision on review is to be made on the agency record, the duty of the court with respect to issues of fact shall be limited to ascertaining whether there is substantial evidence in the agency record, which the agency as the trier of facts could reasonably find them as they did. In other words, issues of law are always reviewable de novo. That's the standard of review on all issues of law. Issues of fact are restricted. In other words, the court simply can't retry the facts. That's the agency's job. And that's essentially what we said. Both forms of the statute have advised. So you seem to be suggesting there was this sea change in the way the standard of review is to be applied to these kinds of cases. And I'm just struggling with, you know, where this big sea change is, because I just don't see it.
If it's clear that issues of law receive a tiered level of deference,
there's no level of deference to issues of law. It's zero. It's de novo. It's always been de novo, and it is now, I would suggest to you.
Well, the Attorney General's office is arguing that when there's an issue of law that deals with the agency's interpretation of its own regulation, that is not pure de novo. It's to be.
Well, I guess maybe the nuance, in fairness, I think I get what you're saying now. The nuance is when you have an agency, there are areas that are clearly within their areas of expertise. You know, the environmental DEQ, for example, air quality, that sort of the water quality, that sort of thing. There are scientific issues which are clearly within their area of expertise. And so when they regulate as to parts per million of, you know, pollutants or whatever, we owe a lot of deference to that because we don't have any expertise in those scientific areas. But on pure questions of law, we do have, or at least, you know, we theoretically have some expertise in that area, and that's why we apply the de novo standard.
Right. So what does it mean to sell drinks two for one, or to sell two or more drinks for the price of one, such as two for one or three for one? And I respect, even though, of course, every issue involves facts, it's a legal issue. What do those words mean, to sell two for one, to sell two or more drinks for the price of one?
Well, that's a great vagueness argument that's never been made anywhere. You know, when I first saw this case, quite honestly, I thought, well, maybe this is a vagueness argument, or, you know, constitutional vagueness argument that's being made here, but it wasn't. And you know, so we can't obviously decide issues not before us. And I'm not suggesting that as to how that might turn out if it ever did come before us. But it seemed to me that was a more obvious objection to the manner of the way this regulation was being promulgated and applied than the one that actually is the assignment of error here, to be
sure.
Honest with you.
Perhaps the regulation could have been written more clearly, and perhaps there is a vagueness issue out there. As argued to the circuit court, you have to look at the agency's regulation, you have to look at the express language in that regulation 5-50-160B4, which says selling two or more drinks for the price of one, such as two for one in quotes or three for one in quotes. What does that language mean? We can't ignore the second half of that regulation. The first half being selling two or more drinks for the price of one, comma, second half being such as two for one or three for one. So the express language in those examples, two for one or three for one, clarifies the preceding words before it. That language in the second half matters. Statutory construction is a holistic endeavor, as the Supreme Court of the United States has said, and appellate courts here have said. So the position of the Attorney General's office seems to be that it's a violation if you sell two drinks for the price, for one price. They seem to be hung up on the fact.
Well, we don't even have a definition of a drink. But whatever. That's not before us either. So the regulation says you can't sell two things for one price, basically, or three things for one price. That's the regulation. Whether it's a good regulation or a bad regulation is not our call. Whether it's a constitutional regulation or an unconstitutional regulation is also not our call because it's not before us. The only thing that is before our call is it a regulation and was it violated?
Right. And if the agency's interpretation is either plainly erroneous or if it's inconsistent with the regulation being interpreted, then it is appropriate to overrule it or find that there's not a violation.
Okay.
There actually
just
is.
Just want to let you know you're now into your rebuttal time. You can keep on going or stop whenever you want.
I'll save for rebuttal.
All right, we'll hear from the Commonwealth.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Christina Stoney. On behalf of ABC, we're here today to ask this Court affirm the Circuit Court's decision to dismiss Warawara's petition for appeal. It is our position that the Circuit Court...
I'm sorry, you want us to dismiss it?
Sorry, affirm
or affirm, okay. I thought I heard you say dismiss the appeal. I was wondering where that was coming from.
The Circuit Court dismissed the appeal.
Oh, I see, okay.
The Circuit Court properly applied the standard of review, and as Your Honor, Judge Humphreys pointed out, this was a procedural...
Can I ask you, I mean, this may be a dumb question, it probably is. From an economic perspective, what is the difference between having one drink, let's say you can get 10 shots out of it for $100, or 10 drinks for $10? I mean, where's the difference to the ABC or to anybody, to the health and safety of the Commonwealth, when the guy pulls out 10 $10 bills and then there's a bottle and he gets 10 shots out of it, or he buys 10 different drinks for $10 each?
Well, first of all, one person couldn't buy 10 drinks at one time. That's also a violation of the ABC laws. But it all sort of goes back to the basic purpose of the ABC laws to prohibit overconsumption, abuse of the consumption of alcohol. And of course, it's all rooted in prohibition.
And as I understand it, a seller is not supposed to sell to sell. Now, I'm not sure how in practice this works out, but isn't supposed to sell alcohol to someone who's noticeably intoxicated.
True.
So if you buy one drink for $100, it's this huge drink, versus 10 different drinks. If on the fifth shot the person is visibly intoxicated, then at least in theory, that bar is supposed to then say, I'm sorry, I can't give you any more because you're intoxicated and I have to follow the law.
Yes, right? They've got a responsibility as a licensed restaurant.
Okay, all right.
And we do have a definition of a drink.
Yeah, Judge McCall pointed that out to me, and
it is
frankly a bit vague. But yes. Go ahead.
It's not as strict as some other control states, which have a limited pour, a certain amount of ounces. Of course, that's not the issue here. But
a customary drink isn't the whole bottle.
Correct. There is a regulatory provision that prohibits an entire bottle of distilled spirits from being served as one drink. So we've got this.
And what's the statutory reference for?
I believe it is 3 VAC 5-50-60.
I think I have that in my notes.
It's not.
Yep, I've got it.
5-50-60, did you say?
Yes, A2.
That it prohibits the sale as one drink of the entire contents of spirits in its original container for on-premises consumption. And then there's some exceptions that I don't think are applicable.
Yes, there are exceptions for sake and hotel restaurants and things like that. But to get back to sort of your original question, sort of the impetus behind this prohibition. You'll see that the regulatory section that is in question today, 3 VAC 5-50-160, talks about happy hour and related promotions. ABC is attempting to regulate types of promotions that would urge, entice, or entreat overconsumption of alcoholic beverages. That's a that's statutory language that ABC has been given by the General Assembly to enforce its statutory duty to promote safe consumption of alcoholic beverages. So if, and obviously we know, you know, companies use marketing schemes all the time, you know, 10 for two or, you know, two for one, buy one, get one free. That is intended to up the purchase. It's intended to make the consumer buy more. ABC recognizes that and has tried to put in their regulatory scheme prohibitions that would be flexible, but also be able to work to prohibit that type of urging overconsumption and over purchasing alcoholic beverages. So I just wanted to speak to the standard of review question. I don't think that the amendments, I think they've sort of been fully vetted by Mr. Kaminsky and by the court. They don't really affect this case at all, in my opinion, because the amendments to the language really only have to do with questions of fact. You do have those two sentences at the end of paragraph three that were also added, but that essentially was just a codification of what the court's practice already was.
Well, I guess I gather your argument in that connection really comes down to, in response to your opponent, simply that the board, as opposed to us, is in the best position to define what two for one means or three for one, that sort of thing?
To the extent that it would be an interpretation within their specialized competence. And I believe that it's clear language. I don't think that there's any question, even if this court was to give no deference to the agency, that two for one price, because that's what we're talking about, not two for the price.
An 8-for-1 price.
I'm sorry?
Or an 8-for-1 price.
Well, if you boil this down, it's, you know, 22 for the price of 12.5. It was a bottle of Johnny Walker Black and a fruit plate sold for $100. The testimony on the record establishes that they were reducing the price from $8 a shot to less than that. So they were essentially selling 22 shots. It's really would have been $176 for a bottle if they were going $8 a shot and 22 shots a bottle. It boils down to its lowest common denominator. Well, not lowest, but 22 shots for the price of 12.5, which is a clear violation of this regulation. The language that follows, such as, in quotes, 2-for-1, 3-for-1, that's a non-exhaustive list of examples. The agency is attempting to try and provide, you know, examples to the regulated industry on how this.
Well, I think this gets back to the earlier question I asked. I mean, drink is defined, but it's not defined all that clearly, and you know, it's kind of a circular definition. It's, you know, any beverage containing an amount of alcohol customarily served. You know, so I mean, if you pour generously in one establishment, you get fewer drinks out of a bottle as opposed. And I guess at some point you cross a line, but I guess my point is leaving it up to the agency to decide where their line, that line is on a case-by-case basis invites a lot of disparity, it seems to me. So.
Well, that's true, but I would argue that that's not really
what that's not what the issue is before us, strictly speaking, but it's ancillary, at least it seems to me it's ancillary in the sense that you can sort of see why licensees would be somewhat confused by some of this stuff. This is not necessarily, you know, that vague of a situation, but I can certainly easily conceive of situations very similar to this that you would get closer to that line and it would be a little more problematic.
Correct, and licensees certainly might get confused, and this licensee in particular had a prior violation, which I mentioned in my brief, and those facts, contrary to Mr. Kinski's position, were in the record, page 23, footnote 2. The licensee was selling bottles of Johnny Walker Black in a slightly different manner and was found to be in violation of the board's regulations. They tweaked, so to speak, their manner of sale and brought up on another violation, the present violation that we have here. What the YCC should have done was sought clarification as to what they could do if they were confused, rather than try and make an end run around the prohibitions.
Is that a regular practice with ABC, where someone can call somewhere and say, hey, we want to do this, is that going to be a problem?
Absolutely, that is a general practice. Every licensee has an assigned agent, and counsel for licensees typically will contact ABC, and ABC issues circular letters and guidance documents related to these types of issues all the time. I do want to touch on the one issue that I think has been discussed today, and that is the consumption after hours and the good faith reliance defense that Wara Wara raises.
I can't find testimony anywhere that someone actually looked at this website.
And that is my exact point.
It's one thing. I mean, you could have some crazy stuff out there, but if no one's looking at it, how can there ever be detrimental reliance?
You're correct, Your Honor. We would argue that there was no affirmative act on behalf of the government, and even if the licensee, even if Wara Wara had established in the record that Mr. Quark had seen this information on the website, and that is what led him to his misunderstanding of ABC's laws, that still would not be enough to...
That's maybe a trickier issue, but I don't know that we need to go there.
Correct. I mean, this argument was, or this defense was only raised before the ABC board, but the evidence of the website's summary of laws, I'll call them, was brought about at the initial hearing officer's decision as sort of a mitigating argument. Okay. As to the attorney's fees issues, I'll just briefly state that Wara Wara has not substantially prevailed, and so attorney's fees should not be awarded. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to ask them. But I believe I've hit all of my points.
Thank you, counsel.
Has the website been clarified?
We're waiting on the outcome of this case.
Okay.
I don't think we do web design. I don't think that's in our job description, but maybe it should be. All right, counsel.
Regarding,
am I wrong about that? I mean, I couldn't find testimony. It's one thing for someone to say, hey, I was trying to figure out what to do. I went to the website. The website says do X, so I did X, and now here I am in trouble having relied on the website. I can't find testimony.
Judge McCall, you're right. There's no express laid out evidence of that. The hearing officer found that the licensees did not know, so I think it's implied.
Okay. All right.
Or perhaps could be inferred reasonably, I would argue. But it is not expressly there. On the issue of the standard review, the Supreme Court of Virginia and this court has ruled a number of times after the 2013 amendments were in effect. The Attorney General cites six cases in her brief. I don't recall the Blue Ridge case, Judge Humphreys, you mentioned, but of the six cases that the AG cites, none of those published cases actually deal with the issue of reviewing agencies' interpretation of their own regulation. Now, the Chincoteague Inn case dealt with pure statutory construction, review de novo. We all agree on that. So did the KEPA case, statutory construction, pure de novo. The First Stop Medical Services case, again, same thing. The Life Care Medical Transport case dealt with factual issues, and then there was also an issue on a public notice requirement, whether that was in accord with law, and the factual issues dealt with the substantial evidence test, which, as the AG points out, is less of a concern here, because we're not really disagreeing on factual issues. Then there was the Atlantic Environmental Construction case. That was de novo review of circuit court's application of the doctrine of respondeat superior, so we're dealing with a pure legal question. None of those five have to do with the court's review of an agency's interpretation of its own regulation. Now, the Lewis Gale Medical Center LLC case, that was unpublished, and I was wondering to what extent were any of these cases in circuit court before July 1st, 2013, because if they were in court before July 1st, 2013, then of course if we could go back in time, any circuit court in this Commonwealth should be applying the pre-2013 amendments, of course. And so there would never be the issue that would come up, are they applying the new amendments correctly or not? And in fact, when I looked at, I tried to reconstruct the timeline from the Lewis Gale Medical Center, and I was wondering, I see obviously in the unpublished opinion's face that it was decided on April 29, 2014, and I was wondering when was it in circuit court? Before before July of 2013 or not. And from the Court of Appeals case information website, I see that a copy of the notice of appeal was received by this court on July 12, 2013, which reasonably might suggest that it was in circuit court before July 1st, 2013.
Let me clarify. The Blue Ridge case that I referred to, that was actually a 2010 case, but the statutory amendment lifts the language from that case and puts it in the statute, basically. So I think I had it the other way around. I think I suggested that the Blue Ridge came after the statutory amendment. It was the other way around. But the language is identical.
Yes, sir. Although with the again, the General Assembly saying the de novo review for questions of law, period. Questions of law, it's not broken up. And so I would suggest that is the General Assembly deciding we're going to put positive new language into the statute that says if it's an issue of law, it's de novo, period. That's what it means. There's no tiered or
special.
Are
we still supposed
deference.
To take due account of the agency's specialized?
According to the General Assembly's amendments in 2013, the answer is no. It says that this court or the circuit court shall review questions of law de novo, simply put. On the issue of this two-for-one, there was some talk about whether it's a violation to serve the bottle. Yes, it is a violation to serve the bottle. Here, there's absolutely no evidence that there was so-called bottle service, and that was actually, there's no finding of facts on that. Specifically, the appendix, page 53, the agent testified that empty bottles were found in the service area. There was no customers in it. It was after 2 o'clock. On page 54, the agent, the ABC investigating agent said she never asked anyone there, did they serve the bottle? And on page 74 and 75, the manager, Mr. Quark, testified unimpeached, uncontradicted, there was no bottle service. The bottle was always kept at the bar. So that's really not an issue before the court. It's did this receipt, these receipts that they found after hours, does that reflect a violation of the regulation?
Mr. Ketsky, your time is up, so you want to go ahead and wrap it up real quick if you want.
The AG talks about that the purpose is to prohibit overconsumption of alcohol. It's arbitrary for the ABC board to say we're going to treat the manner of sale here as a violation, but if someone went in and bought a bottle of wine or a larger beer compared to a smaller beer, it's apparently would be a violation if a bar or licensee discounted the price. And it's clearly not. You look at the face of the regulation. For them to interpret it in this particular case, for our licensee, it's arbitrary.
All right, thank you, counsel. We're going to come down to Greek counsel, and then we'll take up.